Chapter 28. The Roman Empire. The Roman Gods. We learned earlier that the Etruscan tribes of Italy went to Greece to buy and sell. In Greece, they learned about the Greek gods and heard Greek myths. And when they came back to Italy, they passed these stories along to the Romans. The Romans took the Greek gods as their own. They worshipped the gods of Greece. But they called these Greek gods by their own Roman names. Do you remember Zeus, the king of the Greek gods? He made the golden apple so that he could start the Trojan War on Earth. In Rome, Zeus was called Jupiter. He controlled the sky, the moon, and the weather. Wind, rain, and thunder. Today we call one of the planets in our solar system, Jupiter, after the Roman name of the king of the gods. The planet Mars is also named after a Roman god, the god of war. And do you remember the god of the sea, Poseidon, who tried to keep Odysseus from getting home? The Romans called this sea god Neptune. Our solar system also has a planet named Neptune. The Romans told stories of their gods to explain the natural world. One story, about Ceres and her daughter Proserpina, tries to show why winter and summer come every year. One day, Ceres, the goddess of the harvest, and her daughter Proserpina were roaming through the woods. Wherever Ceres stepped, ripe grain sprang up. Whenever she touched a tree, fruit blossomed beneath her hands. Her daughter followed along behind her, as beautiful as springtime, with long golden hair. Ceres stopped for a moment to drink from a cool stream. While she drank, Proserpina wandered away to a beautiful clump of lilies nearby. As she bent down to pick them, the ground suddenly opened beneath her, and she disappeared. When Ceres looked up, Proserpina was gone. "Proserpina," Ceres called. "Proserpina, where are you?" But there was no answer. For 14 days, Ceres wandered the earth looking for her lost daughter. Finally, Ceres met a nymph who whispered,
"I have just come from the underworld, land of the dead. I saw your daughter there. She was stolen by Hades, the king of the underworld, to be his wife. When he saw her, he fell in love with her, and the ground opened up beneath her so that she could walk through it into the land underground."
When Ceres heard this, she was furious.
"I have helped the ground to bear crops," she shouted. "And this is how it rewards me? I will curse it until it is dry and empty of all life."
Instantly, the trees around her began to turn brown, and the leaves fell from them. The grass died, and the flowers withered. In great rage, Ceres turned and climbed up into the heavens, all the way to the palace of Jupiter, king of the gods.
"Jupiter," she said, "force Hades to return my daughter to me. If you don't, I will never again let spring come to the earth. There will never be fruit or grain or grass again. The earth will always be as dead and hard as my heart without my daughter."
Jupiter thought about this. "Very well," he said at last. "I will tell Hades to let your daughter go, on one condition. She can leave the underworld as long as she hasn't eaten or drunk anything in the palace of Hades. But if she ate or drank with him there, she will have to stay." Suddenly, the earth cracked open. There stood Proserpina, beside a tall, dark man in a black cloak. Hades, lord of the underworld.
"My daughter!"
Ceres exclaimed. "Wait," Jupiter said. "Proserpina, have you eaten or drunk anything in the underworld?"
"Hardly anything,"
the girl said.
"I only ate 6 seeds from a pomegranate just a few minutes ago."
"Then you must stay with Hades," Jupiter said. But Ceres refused to give in.
"If I don't get my daughter back," she warned, "spring will never come again."
Jupiter considered the case carefully. At last he said, "She only ate 6 seeds. So for 6 months, half of the year, she must stay in the underworld with Hades. But for the other 6 months, she can come and live with her mother in the world above." And so Proserpina spends 6 months of every year in the underworld. When she is in the palace of Hades, her mother Ceres mourns and weeps. The leaves fall from the trees, the grass turns brown, and the flowers die. But when Proserpina comes back to her mother each spring, Ceres rejoices. The leaves of the trees begin to grow. The grass turns green again, and flowers begin to bud and bloom. The Roman Builders. The Romans weren't content to just stay in their little city of Rome. The bigger the city got, the more land the Romans wanted. And the best way to get land was to take it from other towns and tribes. So the Romans attacked their neighbors and conquered them. The more land they conquered, the richer they got. Soon, Rome controlled the whole Italian peninsula. Now that Rome ruled all of Italy, the Romans needed to be able to travel easily from one end of the peninsula to the others, so they began to build roads. Most roads in the ancient world were rough, muddy tracks filled with holes and blocked by rocks and fallen trees. But the Romans built roads that were easy to travel on. First, they dug a wide ditch and filled the ditch with sand. Then they poured small stones on top of the sand. Next, they poured concrete over top of the stones. Finally, they laid wide, smooth paving stones on top of the concrete. Along the road, the Romans put up stone pillars and carved on them the distance between towns. A traveler on a Roman road could look at these milestones and know exactly how much farther he had to go. The Romans became famous for their beautiful roads. The most famous of all Roman roads was called the Appian Way. It led from Rome to several large Roman cities in Italy. The Appian Way can still be used today. Roman roads were so well built that they lasted for hundreds of years. Today, many roads in Italy still follow the tracks of the old Roman roads. The Romans were the first ancient people to use concrete. They discovered that if they mixed volcanic ash, water, and lime, the soupy mixture would dry as hard as stone. They used this concrete to cement large stones together into buildings and roads. The Romans built whole apartment buildings out of concrete. Some of these ancient apartment buildings were 5 stories high. One Roman writer tells the true story of an ox who escaped from his owner on market day and ran into an apartment building. It kept climbing up higher and higher and higher until it reached the top floor, and then it jumped out of a window. Unfortunately, some of the apartment buildings weren't very well built, and they collapsed, sometimes killing the people who lived inside. Others were slums, without any water or toilets. Whole families lived in one room. They dumped their waste out the windows into the streets. As the Roman cities grew larger and larger, the people who lived in them needed more and more fresh water. So the Romans designed special channels for water called aqueducts. The aqueducts were like narrow stone bridges with water pipes that ran across the top of them. Through these aqueducts, the Romans could bring water into the cities from springs 30 miles away. The Romans needed water for drinking and cooking, but also for taking baths. Baths were very important to the ancient Romans. Most of them took a bath every day, but they didn't bathe in a bathtub like you do. Instead, they went to the public baths, which were more like swimming pools. People gathered at the public baths to get clean. They rubbed soap made from animal fat on their skin and then scraped themselves clean with special curved blades. Then they could swim in cold or hot water brought in by the aqueducts. Today, the ruins of Roman roads, buildings, baths, and aqueducts can still be found in the places where the Romans lived, even though they were built more than 2,000 years ago. The Roman Gladiators. Today we're going to read a story about a man who became a Roman gladiator, someone who fought with other men as a game. The man in the story, Servius, is imaginary, but there were thousands of men just like him in ancient Rome. Servius lived in a small village near the sea. He spent his days working with metal. He made plows and hoes for the farmers who lived near him, and fish hooks for the fishermen. He liked his work. At night, he would sit with his friends around a fire and talk, sing songs, and tell stories. Servius was happy. One day, as Servius was heating the metal to make a new hoe, he heard a thundering noise. He looked up, wondering if it were about to rain. But the noise wasn't thunder. It was the sound of horses' hooves. Around the corner of the peaceful village rode a group of men with swords, shields, and spears. They wore helmets and red cloaks. "We are Romans," the biggest man shouted. "We claim this village for Rome. Now you must obey us." Servius looked around for a weapon, but all he could see was a hoe hanging on the wall. He grabbed it and swung it at the man, but he missed. Two other Roman soldiers leaped from their horses and seized Servius from behind. "You are our prisoner," the big man said. "You'll return with us to Rome." They put Servius on a horse and made him ride with them for days and days down a broad, wide road of stone. Finally, Servius saw the wall of a city ahead. It was the highest wall he had ever seen. A man standing on another man's shoulders couldn't even see over it. The soldiers took him through a small gate in the city wall. When they came out the other side, Servius found himself in a narrow, crowded street full of people. Little wooden booths lined both sides of the street. Inside the booths, men and women were selling fruit, pieces of cooked meat, bread, cabbages, and carrots, and jugs of cheap wine. Children ran down the middle of the street, chasing a mangy dog. Women hung laundry on wooden balconies above the street. He could hear babies crying, men shouting, women talking to each other, horses and donkeys neighing. He had never seen so many people in one place at the same time. Soon the street grew wider, and the houses grew bigger. Servius began to see green gardens, fountains, and houses made out of white marble. There were fewer people here, and they were dressed in fancier clothes. White togas with borders of red and blue. They were approaching the center of Rome. "Where are you taking me?" Servius asked one of the soldiers who rode beside him. "To the gladiator school," the soldier said. "You're big and strong, and you have courage. You'll make a great fighter once the trainers at the school have taught you what to do." Servius felt his mouth grow dry with fright. He had heard about the notorious gladiators of Rome, fierce men who fought with each other and with wild animals, while a cheering crowd looked on. "But what if I don't want to be a gladiator?" he said. "You don't have any choice," the soldier answered. "You're our prisoner. Go to the gladiator school or be executed." They stopped at a high stone wall, and two Romans took Servius through the gate. Inside, a large courtyard was full of men training for their gladiator matches. At the center, a man wearing only a loincloth and a belt was trying to throw a fishnet over his opponent. He brandished a three-pointed spear in his other hand. The man who fought against him was waving a short sword and defending himself with a large round shield. His helmet was covered with pictures of fish. "The man with the net is called a net fighter," one of the soldiers told Servius. "The other one is a fish man. The net fighter is trying to catch him in the net and stab him. Maybe if you're lucky, you'll learn how to be a net fighter." Servius's knees were shaking with terror. If this was just the training camp, what would it be like to fight a real gladiator fight in the arena? How could he ever survive? The Gladiator School. At the Gladiator School, Servius lived in a cell just like a prison cell. But he was taken out every day for gladiator training. First, he had to pass a test to see how fit he was. Two trainers, big men with scars on their faces, wearing armor and carrying short, sharp swords, walked all around him. They poked him and squeezed his arms. Then they pointed to a post 100 feet away.
"How quickly can you run to that post and back?" one asked.
Servius scowled at the man. He didn't want to learn how to fight, but if he didn't, he would be killed. Finally, he turned around and ran to the post and back.
"Very good," the trainer said. "Now let's see how you do for endurance."
For the rest of the day, the two trainers forced Servius to run, jump, wrestle, and climb. By night, he was covered with sweat and mud and was so tired he could hardly drag himself back to his cell. But he had passed the test. The next day, Servius stood in the courtyard along with 5 other new prisoners.
"You will be gladiators," one of the trainers shouted. "Repeat after me the oath of the gladiator. I undertake to be burnt by fire, to be bound in chains, to be beaten by rods, and to die by the sword. To be a gladiator is a wonderful privilege. You are indeed lucky."
Servius swallowed nervously. He didn't feel lucky. But all around him, the other prisoners were repeating the gladiator's oath, so he took the oath as well. The next thing he knew, they were being marched off to their first training exercise, swinging wooden swords at straw men propped up against the gladiator school wall. The trainers had once been gladiators. They taught Servius and the other new recruits sword fighting moves. When Servius had learned the moves, he then fought against one of the other gladiator students. They both had wooden swords, so no one got killed. But Servius didn't parry quickly enough, and the other student's wooden sword crashed against his side. He was sore for days, but the trainers just laughed at him.
"You'd better learn to be tough," one of them said. "We don't care if it hurts. Just keep fighting. You'll get hurt worse than that when you fight in the arena."
In the arena, Servius's heart sank. He already knew that his first fight in the arena was only a week away. He was to be a secutor, a gladiator who chased net fighters around the arena. He had already practiced fighting with his real weapons and armor, a short, strong sword, a large shield, and a metal leg guard that covered his left leg. On his head, he wore a round helmet with 2 tiny eye holes. He could barely see out of the helmet. How would he ever catch a net fighter? What if the net fighter caught him first? On the day of the fight, Servius was taken to the arena, a large bare space near the outer walls of Rome. Wooden seats had been built all around it. They were filled with men and women, and even children. All of them were cheering and shouting. They were enjoying this. Servius's trainer put his helmet on and tightened his armor.
"Go get him,"
he said, and pushed Servius into the arena. The metal helmet was hot and tight. Servius felt like he could barely breathe. He turned his head and caught sight of his opponent, a net fighter, creeping towards him from the other side of the arena. The net fighter threw his net. Servius felt it strike against his shield. He advanced forward, waving his sword. The net fighter backed away. Suddenly, he turned and began to run. "He's as frightened as I am," Servius thought. He started to chase the net fighter. His heavy armor slowed him down. The net fighter wasn't wearing armor. He was getting away. Suddenly, the net fighter tripped and stumbled. Before he knew it, Servius was standing right over top of him. He could hardly believe it. He had won the match. He put his foot on the net fighter's chest and looked around him. The crowd was booing and making the thumbs down sign. Servius knew what that meant. They wanted him to kill his opponent. If the net fighter had been brave and bold, the crowd might have had pity on him and turned their thumbs up. Then Servius could show mercy and let the other man live. but he was supposed to do whatever the crowd said. Servius looked down. The net fighter knew what the thumbs down meant. He had closed his eyes. He thought he was about to die. Servius stepped back and put his sword back in its sheath. "Get up," he said. "I can't kill you. I am not an animal. I know that it would be wrong to kill a man for sport." The net fighter scrambled away from him, hardly able to believe his ears. The crowd was booing louder and louder. They wanted to see blood. But Servius turned around and walked back towards his trainer. He knew he would be punished. Maybe he would even be killed. But he knew now that he could not kill another man. The Romans were great, powerful people, but they were also bloodthirsty. They liked to see men hurt. They enjoyed seeing blood. Some of the historians who lived in Rome thought that this bloodthirstiness was wrong and evil. They wrote about men like Servius, who refused to kill their opponents in the arena. Some even killed themselves so that they would not be forced to kill other men. The Roman philosopher Seneca wrote in a letter to a friend, "The show was even better to watch when this happened, because the men in the audience learned that it is more decent to die than to kill."